it's time for Native Sun, a program bringing you indigenous news stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Today's articles come from Native News Online. The first is Childhood Exam Motivates Dental Hygienist Who Cares for Rural Kids by Chandra Martinez. When Linda Gregorini, a citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe, was 10 years old, a routine school vision screening changed her life. Her family didn't know she needed glasses. There had never been money or access for something like an eye doctor. They stood me on a line and asked me to read the letters. I couldn't, she says. That was the first time anyone realized I had a vision problem. After I got glasses, my grades improved almost overnight. I could finally see. That moment of clarity shaped her future. Today, Gregorini is a dental hygienist, nonprofit founder, and one of Michigan's first hygienist-inspired ambassadors, a role she uses to support students across Michigan's Upper Peninsula, just as that school nurse once supported her. Instead of vision checks, she provides preventative dental care to children who might not otherwise have access. I want to be that person who helps kids catch something early, before it turns into a bigger problem, she says. That little moment made a huge difference in my life. I want to pass that on. Filling a major health need. Her Sault Ste. Marie-based nonprofit, UP Superior Smiles, delivers dental assessments, cleaning, sealants, fluoride treatments, and cavity arrest therapies to schools in rural and underserved communities. Gregorini's goal is to meet kids where they are, especially those whose families can't afford or access regular dental care. The need is growing. Dental hygiene jobs are projected to increase 9% by 2033, nearly double the national average. Meanwhile, workforce shortages, clinic no-shows, and rising costs continue to limit access in rural regions. The Hygest-inspired program, a joint initiative from the Dental Dental Foundation and the American Dental Hygienists Association, was launched to help address these issues by recruiting hygienists from the communities they serve. Gregorini, a member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, learned about the program through Dr. Jessica A. Rickert, Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation, who in 1975 became the first Native American woman in the U.S. to earn a dental degree. Rickert most recently served as the Anishinaabe Dental Outreach Specialist for Delta Dental of Michigan and continues to advocate for Native representation in healthcare. Jessica has been such an inspiration, Gregorini says. She's dedicated her life to this work, and that motivated me to get involved. As an ambassador, Gregorini promotes dental hygiene as a career by connecting it with schools, guidance counselors, and local dental offices. She also mentors students, especially Native youth, who may not realize dental careers are within reach. I always ask students, "Would you ever want to do this?" she says. "We need more hygienists. We need more people from our own communities." Long route to career. Gregorini didn't take a straight path to becoming a dental hygienist. She became a mother at 19 and started working in a dental office in her 20s. At first, she worked at the front desk, then helped as a dental assistant. One day, she accidentally opened the dental hygienist's paycheck. "She was making three times what I was," Gregorini says, "and I was working just as hard. That opened my eyes." She decided to return to school. At the time, she was in her early 30s, married, raising two children, and taking care of her home. She enrolled at Ferris State University in Big Rapids as a non-traditional student, despite the four-hour commute and the lack of a car. To get there and back, she rode the Greyhound bus and came home on weekends, when possible, to be with her husband and children. Right before classes were about to start, she found a lump in her breast. A biopsy showed it was cancer. She had to pause her education to go through chemotherapy and radiation. "I thought that might be the end of it," she says. "But once I finished treatment, I knew I had to try again." She re-enrolled the next year and completed her degree. Ever since, she has focused her career on public health, drawn to its ability to reach patients who aren't walking through traditional clinic doors. Working in schools. In 2021, she launched UP Superior Smiles to provide dental care in school settings. Her nonprofit targets schools where at least half of the students qualify for free or reduced lunch. Last year, she provided services to more than 750 children. "It's a more efficient model," she says. "If a student is absent, I move on to the next. If someone is scared, I work with them over several days until they're ready." Some students are anxious about treatment. Gregorini pairs them with peers who have already been treated so they can hear firsthand what to expect. I'll say, "Susie, tell Johnny how it went." And she'll say, "It didn't hurt. It was fine." That helps calm their nerves, she says. When students have more serious dental needs, Gregorini refers them to partner clinics. Her nonprofit has formal agreements with area dental centers that allow her to securely share records and communicate directly with providers. "They know if I'm calling, it's not just a chat," she says. "It means a child needs to be seen quickly." Convincing parents to sign consent forms is one of her biggest barriers. She has experimented with QR codes, hard copy packets, and direct outreach to boost return rates. Some schools have added her form to the required registration materials, which has helped. "I try everything I can," she says, "because without that form, I can't help the child." Other career guidance. Besides providing care, Gregorini sees her work as a way to show students careers they might not think about. Last summer, she got a grant from United Way to hire a high school student intern. The student wants to become an eye doctor, but Gregorini says the internship helped her learn more about other jobs in healthcare too. Another student, a tribal member in ninth grade, wants to become a dentist. Gregorini plans to stay in touch and connect him with a tribal dental provider to shadow when he's older. "I want to be a guide for students like him," she says. "If I can help one person start that journey, it's worth it." School-based care also gives Gregorini the flexibility to reach students in ways clinics can't. She builds trust over time, explains procedures in simple terms, and makes oral health approachable. "I've had students recognize me years later and say, 'That's the lady who helped me at school,'" she says. "It means something to them." It still matters to her. When she remembers the school nurse who noticed her vision problems, she realizes how one person's care made a big difference. "It's not just about clean teeth," Gregorini says. "It's about health, confidence, and giving kids a chance." Our next story comes from the Arizona Republic. "Arsenic in Drinking Water Could Affect Brain Activity" by Austin Corona. Before the town of Bouse overhauled its groundwater system in 2025, residents were hesitant to drink from their taps. More specifically, Bouse residents were wary of drinking arsenic, a common pollutant in Arizona's aquifers. "For years, we would buy 5-gallon water bottles and put them on a stand in our kitchen," Bouse resident Carrie McBain said in an interview. A new study from Clemson University could add weight to those fears, seeming to confirm that the first time that arsenic exposure can lead to widespread damage to neurological systems like vision and motor function. The study casts a new light on an issue that has plagued southwestern communities for decades. Almost one-fifth of the main aquifers in the southwestern United States contain levels of arsenic above federal drinking water regulations, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Cities and towns can remove arsenic from groundwater, but some rural communities and isolated homes can't afford those options, leaving residents to consume polluted water or haul it in from elsewhere. The new study released in July shows that scientists are only beginning to understand the full effects of arsenic poisoning. While researchers have linked the toxic metal with cancer, reduced intelligence in children, and locomotive dysfunction, they still don't know exactly why it affects the brain. Researchers gave non-lethal, regular doses of arsenic to groups of fruit flies and watched how it affected the flies' motor skills and lifespan. After the flies had died, the team dissected their brains and analyzed each of their individual cells, searching for the areas affected by arsenic. It basically crippled the whole fly, meaning they could not function the way they're supposed to function anymore, said Anurag Chaturvedi, a postdoctoral student at Clemson Center for Human Genetics, who led the study. Fruit flies help researchers find arsenic link. Researchers have found that arsenic can affect body movements and visual systems in humans, but the new study suggests the neurological effects go much deeper, potentially affecting the entire brain. It was known that few of the systems were impacted by arsenic neurotoxicity. However, in our study, we identified that not a few, but actually almost all of the known systems of neurotransmitters and transporters were impacted in the fly's brain, Chaturvedi said. Researchers commonly use fruit flies for medical research because the insects have remarkably similar genetic codes to humans, though smaller and more basic. Though the effect on the fruit fly doesn't perfectly mirror effects on humans, the flies show what systems in humans are likely affected by the same toxins. While still alive, the flies showed that the arsenic exposure limited their ability to orient themselves in space and move around. Locomotive impairment is a known symptom of arsenic exposure in humans, but vision-related issues are less documented. Chaturvedi said the Clemson study could illuminate the backstory behind a mysterious case published in a 2020 article in which high arsenic levels in well water at a man's weekend cottage, the location was undisclosed, caused his vision to deteriorate in both eyes. Doctors couldn't figure out the culprit behind his visual decline for years until they discovered the high arsenic concentration in his system and tested the cottage as well. The 70-year-old man had spent every weekend at the cottage for 28 years, drinking entirely from the well. We identified that the vision system was impacted. Then I went to look at whether there was any evidence in humans for some such adverse outcomes, Chaturvedi said, and indeed, this was the case. Knowing that the fly systems correlate so well with the human systems, Chaturvedi said, researchers can now use artificial intelligence trained on a wealth of genetic data from the fruit fly experiments to predict how observed impacts on the flies will translate to humans. Arsenic is a bigger problem in rural communities. Future research could also expose what genes make individual flies and humans more or less vulnerable to arsenic poisoning, Chaturvedi said. The effects of arsenic vary widely from person to person, with some people experiencing no symptoms at all. Clemson scientists hope to learn more about the mechanics behind the variability. An estimated 140 million people in at least 70 countries regularly drink water contaminated by arsenic at levels above what the World Health Organization deems healthy, according to that organization. Because the arsenic exposure symptoms differ between people and locations, researchers struggle to fully assess arsenic's full impact on global health or successfully mitigate it in places where water treatment infrastructure isn't available. If we understand the pattern and the process that drive those toxicities in flies, we will be able to come up with working hypotheses that can be further tested to understand what might be the mitigations to save populations that might be exposed, Chaturvedi said. In Arizona, arsenic leaches naturally into groundwater supplies from rocks. Water providers usually treat the arsenic out of their water when necessary. Surprise and Sahuarita both have built special arsenic treatment facilities to handle metals in its groundwater. Rural areas have it harder. Spread out homes and small tax bases make it difficult for small water providers to afford treatment facilities to connect individual households who rely on their water wells. The problem is acute in northern Arizona's native communities, where residents must often rely on arsenic-contaminated water as their only local water source. An analysis in 2023 found that 3/4 of residents on the Hopi Reservation relied on arsenic-contaminated groundwater, prompting a $25 million infrastructure project funded by the federal government and the tribe. The first phase of that project was completed in August. Meanwhile, the tiny community of Baus had to apply for a $6.6 million in federal grants and loans to get their system updated. Now that the project's finished, McBain feels more comfortable drinking her tap water. For the people who live here year-round, it was something we all wanted. We all want healthy water, McBain says. Austin Corona covers environmental issues for the Arizona Republic and Arizona Central. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our next story comes from Windspeaker. Feature film from First Nations director will have a world premiere at Toronto Festival by Sam Lascaris. Eva Thomas's dream has become a reality. In a 2023 interview with Windspeaker.com, Thomas discussed her directorial short film debut called Red Lights, which had its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF. Thomas, a member of the Walpole Island First Nation in southwestern Ontario, was working to secure funding to turn her film into a full-length feature. If it all works out toward my plan, hopefully, we'll have a lovely TIFF premiere of the feature in 2 years, Thomas said in August 23. Hopefully, the universe is listening. Nika and Madison is a story of two young First Nations women and their encounter with a police officer. The world premiere is scheduled for September during this year's TIFF Festival. I guess the universe was listening, Thomas told Windspeaker. It feels really fantastic, and I'm really proud of myself that I had this goal and I was able to achieve it. And I'm really happy with the movie that we made, and I'm excited to have been invited to premiere it at TIFF. Red Lights had focused on starlight tours, a practice by police to pick up Indigenous people in a city, often in the dead of winter with freezing temperatures, and drop them off in the outskirts to fend for themselves. Thomas changed her narrative somewhat for Nika and Madison, which takes place in Toronto as well as a fictional First Nation in Ontario. I switched the focus just a bit, Thomas said. The two actresses that were in Red Light were supposed to both be in the feature, and my intention was to expand those characters. Thomas recast when one of the actresses became pregnant and could not take the part. But it's still two Indigenous women who have an encounter with the police, and that's sort of the inciting incident, and at the heart of both of the projects, she said. Thomas is becoming a regular contributor to TIFF. She co-wrote and co-directed a film called Aberdeen, which had its premiere at TIFF in 2024. It is my first solo directorial feature, she said of Nika and Madison. This latest film involves a sexual assault of one of the lead characters at the hands of a police officer. That officer is then physically assaulted, resulting in the search for the two First Nations women. When I started this project a handful of years ago, we were in the midst of the Me Too era, Thomas said. I think victims of sexual assault, we don't focus on them as much and the trauma they faced, so I think that the topic in a way is very timely. With Red Lights, I felt that I had something to say about starlight tours, and I said it. And then I was ready to say something else, which is why I expanded into this feature to have it be more about sexual assault. The two main characters in the film are played by Ellen Jade, Nika, and Star Slade, Madison. I'm really hoping that the viewers will connect with the characters and root for the characters and really find a way to care about these two Indigenous women, Thomas said. Besides her work with Red Lights, Thomas was also a consulting producer on a documentary about human sex trafficking in Ontario. The film features several First Nations women who were survivors and were interviewed about human trafficking and sex work. Many of them talked about how encounters they had with the police, Thomas said. So I think it was a combination of those experiences which led me to sort of expand the story a bit more. Feel like there are women who have had these tales to tell. Thomas said she hopes to explore other topics for future projects. Not to say that I won't revisit this topic in the future, but I have a lot of stories that I want to tell, she says. I've really been keen to tell a story of triumph and Indigenous joy. I work a lot in comedy for television, so I'd like to explore that as well. Following its TIFF screening, Nika and Madison will be shown at the Cinefest Sudbury International Film Festival, which runs through September in Northern Ontario. Thomas said her film has also been accepted into other Canadian film festivals, but details have yet to be announced, and film reps are working on securing an international U.S. premiere. Nika and Madison will have 4 showings at TIFF, which runs through September. Our next story comes from Northern News Services Limited. Inclusiveness essential to improve Indigenous graduation rates, says educator, by Eric Bowling. New statistics reveal only 4 Northwestern Territory communities where 75% of the population has at least a high school diploma. more inclusiveness and supports are needed for Indigenous students in the Northwest Territories if educators want to see higher graduation figures. That's South Slave District Education Authority Superintendent Suhail Suja's perspective on numbers released in August by the NWT Bureau of Statistics, which found just 56.2% of NWT Indigenous residents over the age 15 have a high school diploma. Although the trend is positive, the graduation rates for Indigenous students are barely above 50%, while non-Indigenous graduation rates are soaring at 92%, said Suja. This is problematic. Of the 33 communities in the NWT, there are only four where 75% of the population has at least a high school diploma. Those are Fort Smith, Hay Hiver, Norman Wells, and Yellowknife. Unuvik and Sachs Harbor are close at 71.4% and 72.6%, respectively. Suja said giving students more reasons to participate in the education system and making them feel more welcome are essential because improving attendance rates is the key first step. Create a school environment where students see themselves reflected in the staff and their surroundings, he said. The research suggests that when students are taught by teachers with similar cultural values, their graduation rates increase significantly. Initiatives that prioritize hiring Indigenous teachers in our schools are of great benefit to our students and the community, he said. Simply importing the Southern colonial education system doesn't work, with a punitive top-down approach falling out of favor among educators across the country, he contended. Finding ways to ensure students are challenged academically but still able to succeed is also essential. Why would students want to go to a place where all they experience is failure? Asked Suja. However, we must take great care not to create a false sense of ability. We cannot lower expectations, as that is essentially reverse discrimination. Noting that many families are rightfully suspicious of the education system after multiple generations were affected by trauma from the residential school system, Suja said improving the cultural importance of school among families is paramount to improving attendance. The school year also needs examination, Suja suggested. The Southern model, running from September into June, runs contrary to freeze-thaw cycles of the North, which have shaped human cultures for many millennia. The Fort Resolution District Education Authority is experimenting with a longer school year this fall, starting in August and running through July. The reason for the decision is partially to combat attendance drop in summer months, the risk of fires forcing an evacuation during school, the air quality in June due to forest fires elsewhere, and to take advantage of the fall temperatures. Academic planners were limited in how much they can adjust the schedules, as the timing is partially controlled by a collective agreement between the Union of Northern Workers and the Northwest Territories Teachers Association, which determines the length of employment for teachers and staff, Suja noted. The NWT Education Act dictates the number of instructional days, and up to this fall, being attached to the Alberta curriculum meant students had to complete their year-end exams at the same time as those farther south. However, once the GNWT switches to the BC model this fall, the latter should no longer be an issue. Suja added that there was a great deal of support among educators toward moving to a year-round school model to accommodate northern lifestyles. It accommodates cultural needs and it reduces summer loss, the academic skills students lose over the summer break when they're not academically engaged. This is the biggest detriment for underprivileged students who fall further behind their more privileged peers during the summer. Our next story comes from the Arizona Republic. Activists say mail-in ballots are crucial for Native voters, by Arlisa D. Bicente. President Donald Trump is pushing to eliminate mail-in voting, a change that could disproportionately affect Native American voters by making an already challenging voting process even more difficult. After meeting with the Russian President Putin, Trump claimed on Truth Social that he would lead a movement to eliminate mail-in ballots. In a separate interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity, Trump said Putin told him U.S. elections were rigged because of mail-in voting and that no other country allows it. Trump's remarks seemed to signal his intent to push for ending mail-in voting ahead of the midterms. Choosing to eliminate mail-in ballots in the United States would especially affect Native American voters. The Native American population in Arizona continues to face challenges with rural addressing, distant ballot drop boxes, and unreliable voting equipment, such as the malfunctioning machines during the November elections in Apache County. Across Indian Country, in-person voting and registration options can be prohibitively far. The roads to access them can be poor, and really it's unfair how difficult it is to vote, says Jacqueline De Leon, a senior staff attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, told Arizona Republic. When it comes to mail-in ballots, there are also significant challenges in Native American communities. Many homes do not receive residential mail, meaning Native Americans often have to travel to the post office to access or send a ballot. There can also be a cost associated with mailing the ballot, which can be difficult for many Native Americans. Although Trump has claimed otherwise, the notion that other countries don't allow mail-in voting has been debunked. According to the International IDEA, countries such as Canada, the United Kingdom, and Germany all permit citizens to vote by mail. I think the false narrative around voter fraud is used to implement rules that make it difficult or impossible for Native voters to fairly access the ballot, De Leon said. Native communities should be calling on local officials to implement fair voting access for their upcoming elections, especially fair and equitable in-person options on the reservation. De Leon and the Native American Rights Fund believe that Trump's plans to eliminate mail-in ballots is a false premise, particularly because the president cannot eliminate mail-in ballots on his own. The Constitution gives states and Congress, not the president, authority over elections. Native Americans need options. Only 66% of eligible Native Americans are registered to vote across the country, leaving more than 1 million voting-age Native citizens unregistered, according to the Native American Rights Fund. The American Indian and Alaskan Native population is among the fastest-growing groups in the United States. From 2000 to 2010, it grew by 27%, compared with 9% for the total population, rising from 4.1 million to 5.2 million. As of 2017, the population, including those of more than one race, is estimated to be 6.7 million. By 2060, the American Indian and Alaska Native population is projected to reach 10.2 million alone, or in combination with one or more other races, comprising about 2.4% of the estimated total population, according to the Native American Rights Fund. We don't know how many Native Americans vote by mail, but we do know that Native Americans need options, says De Leon. More options to vote because of how difficult it is to vote in Native communities. A recent example of the Native vote being disrupted in Arizona occurred during the 2024 elections, when Apache County experienced printer malfunctions with its voting machines. The issues led to shortages of provisional ballots on the Navajo Nation, forcing some voters to wait in line for up to 3 hours, while others left their polling sites without voting. Apache County is a reflection of the inequitable distribution of election funding services and working equipment, De Leon says. Rural counties are more likely to get non-functioning equipment. They're more likely to get less access, and I think that Native voters in particular are often left with less access because of that inequitable distribution. De Leon said false claims of voter fraud aren't about making elections safer. The real goal is to disenfranchise vulnerable voters who lack the same infrastructure as others, she said. She pointed to restrictions on ballot collection, framed around unfounded fraud claims, as a prime example. For many Native Americans who often travel 20 to 50 miles for basic services, the ability to pick up and drop off ballots for one another is essential, she said. Limiting this practice highlights how fraud narratives are used as a pretext to deliberately restrict and target certain voters, she said. In a place like Arizona, where statewide elections have been determined by fewer than 300 votes, it's no coincidence that changing the rules to make it more difficult for certain minority groups to vote is an effective way to cut out the voters you don't want, De Leon said. You've been listening to Native Sun, a show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.